You are listening to an American Free Press podcast. Hello and welcome. If you're like most people, you'll come home from work, whenever that might be, watch the news, and believe nearly everything they say. If it's on TV or in the mainstream media in general, it must be true, right? Pat Shannon thought so, until his early adulthood, when the JFK assassination discrepancies caught his attention. Then he began to question. Now, he's written a terrific book called Everything They Ever Told Me Was a Lie. In it, Pat rips away the veneer of respectability that the mainstream media pretends to have and gives the reader a behind-the-scenes look at how major events in America's history most likely occurred. No sugarcoating here, no advertisers to appease, no hidden agendas, no grand claims or pie-in-the-sky postulations. Pat doesn't bite off more than he could chew. Just tons and tons of discrepancies in the official stories of the topics he covers. From Honest Abe to Barry Sotero, a.k.a. Barack Obama, Shannon shows with evidence and facts that what we think we know, we really don't. Pat, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Dave. It's good to be with you.
Pat, the first page of the book is the dedication. It says, this book is dedicated to the diminishing number of honest but frustrated street reporters in the mainstream media who still have the courage to report the facts as they see them, while always knowing that most of the truth will never reach the public view. Pat, most people dedicate their books to a loved one. Why this sort of dedication?
Well, that's an interesting question I never had before, but I guess my experience over the last half century or so, and not only with chapters that are in this book and the incidents and everything else, but actual interviewing and talking with other mainstream reporters on various jobs. For instance, I remember on the Eric Rudolph chase in 1998 up in Andrews, North Carolina, some of the mainstream folks were up there. When I was chasing Bill Greitz and the crew around, they were trying to get Eric to turn himself in. You may remember that was the case where they called him the Mad Bomber, and for 5 years he made monkeys out of the FBI. He hid out there in the woods on his own and was finally captured in 03 when he was trying to get some food out of a garbage can behind a supermarket. But while I was in Andrews in 98, some of these guys, I remember one from Charlotte Observer and some Atlanta folks were standing around talking, and I had told them about some of the things like the bombs inside the Murrah Building in 95 in Oklahoma City. And they, of course, took that with a grain of salt. In no way that could be true, you know. Then I told them about one of the AP Stringer reporters from Helena, Montana, had called once, and I was talking with him on the phone, and I said, when are you guys going to start reporting the truth here about this Montana Freeman siege? And I said, I'm here on the scene. I know exactly what's going on, but it's not what I'm seeing in the Billings Gazette. And he said, I know exactly what you're talking about, because he said, sometimes I'll write a story on a Saturday, and when it appears on the Sunday papers, Associated Press across the country, under my byline, he said, I wondered who wrote it. It's not even the same story I sent in the day before.
Right.
So this is how the editors are behaving, and this is how the street reporters are controlled. It becomes very, very frustrating to them when it happens several times, and finally they just have to realize if they want to do this kind of job, then this is the kind of reporting that's going to go on. So there are honest reporters in the street, and these are the reports that we must pay attention to, both television and newspaper, or not newspaper because it won't get through very quickly, but the on-the-scene reports. When we have another atrocity like 9-1-1 or the Oklahoma City bombing, the early reports, Dave, are the ones that we can trust because these guys are simply telling what they see.
Right.
Oklahoma City was another great example of that discrepancy because everything changed. The thing happened at 9:03 in the morning, and by 2 in the afternoon, the whole story had changed from explosion. First, they thought it was a gas explosion in the building. It was obvious that the building had been blown up inside, but by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, it was an ANFO bomb driven up there in a truck by this guy named Tim McVeigh and blah, blah, blah.
And the story goes on and on. Yeah, just like the fellow that recently was interviewed by a reporter at American Free Press, I think a CNN reporter, Jamie McIntyre, when he first said that there was no plane that hit the Pentagon, then of course the story changed over and over again on 9/11, something like that. That's what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. We've been screaming since the first few days. There had to be charges inside that building. Buildings don't collapse that way, but they just sold it over and over and over, day after day. The building was weakened when the plane hit. You know, if a plane goes into a building, now that we know what was in the interior steel structure of that building, all those vertical columns, when a plane had gone into that, it would have smashed like a beer can. There's no way it could have gotten through there and come out the other side, as they're showing us now on the videos.
Right, exactly. Pat, the book is terrific. classic. And what you're talking about right now reminds me of what I read on page 151, that quote by Wolfgang von Goethe from 1828. The truth must be repeated again and again because error is constantly being preached around us, and not only by isolated individuals, but by the majority. In the newspapers and encyclopedias, in the schools and universities, everywhere, error is dominant, securely and comfortably ensconced in public opinion, which is on its side. And like you said in the book, that was 1828. Has anything changed?
Yeah, what else is new? Well, let me give you a new one that I guess you could say may have even been spawned from the experience of the one you just read. But this is Dresden James. Now, I guess he was a well-known philosopher at one time. But when a well-packaged web of lies has been sold gradually to the masses over generations, the truth will seem utterly preposterous and its speaker a raving lunatic. Well, you know, I'm really surprised that I have been challenged more on this book in the last couple of months since it hit the streets and been called a raving lunatic. Surprisingly, almost all of the stuff that come back has been positive. In fact, the only negative I haven't had any negative response yet from anyone who's read the book, only from those who saw the promo and said, bull, you know, this can't be true. Too Oswald, get a life, man.
Right. Well, I think the most shocking part of the book, for me anyway, when I received it, was the moon landing story. I thought, geez, come on now. Of course we went to the moon. But I just want to say something here about that. I don't want to cover this chapter. And the reason is because I feel it's in the best interests of the person who buys the book to read it for themselves. For me, it was the most shocking chapter of the book, especially the 29 things that need to be answered at the end of the chapter. Let me just say that if, and this is for the listeners, if you believed all along that NASA actually arrived on the moon, like I did, after reading this chapter in Pat's book, I can almost guarantee you'll look at this momentous occasion differently. Pat, that was a terrific chapter, and it really knocked me on my seat because I believed all these years that, yeah, of course we did go to the moon. Now here's this guy coming out and saying, we didn't. And like I said in the introduction, you absolutely don't bite off more than you can chew. You don't scream and rave and wave your arms back and forth and jump up and down. You simply provide the reader with the evidence and the facts. And the facts are more than enough to sow many seeds of doubt in anybody's mind once they see that. And I don't want to cover that chapter only because it's such a terrific chapter, and I don't want to give anything away to the listeners. I think it's in their best interest to go and pick up the book. And just that one chapter is going to make people think differently. I mean, all the chapters really. And somebody like me, who I read a lot, obviously, and it was shocking. The book is just terrific. Pat, what number book is this for you?
Number 7. I have one in there that was called One in a Million that American Free Press is republishing and distributing, I should say, early next year. And that was my only novel. The rest are all nonfiction, but it also is more truth than fiction in the One in a Million story because only my characters were fictitious, but I wove a story around truth. I should just say it's a murder mystery, it's a love story, it's a great expose on the government agencies and how they operate behind the scenes and destroy Americans' lives, called One in a Million. But the others are all nonfiction. I wrote with Tupper, which was kind of a semi-biography of Tupper Saucy, another colleague and fellow author who was my mentor, by the way, in the early days when I was learning the money issue. And he'd written a great book called The Miracle on Main Street, which intrigued me so much. The only book in my life ever. When I finished the last page, I went back to number one and read it again.
Right.
Yeah, I was so intrigued by that. But the problem was that he befriended and wrote James Earl Ray's story, the accused killer of Martin Luther King, back in 1987, called Tennessee Waltz, and was then railroaded on trumped up IRS charges, as they like to do. And instead of reporting, because even Ray had warned him that they will murder him if they get him in prison, so he ended up going on the lam for 10.5 years before another so-called fellow patriot turned him in. But that's all a different story. But Tupper and I was his window to the free world when he was underground for so long. And so that's where the title came from. I rode with Tupper as a double entendre. I rode with him literally in his motorhome when he's traveling out west on the lam. Of course, I rode with him on his wisdom before that.
Well, this book, the title of it is Everything They Ever Told Me Was a Lie. And of course, they has an asterisk next to it. And in the preface, you say, and just who are they anyway? You say, in this report, we'll limit it to elected politicians and bureaucrats who are actually paid to deceive the citizenry, their parrots in the mainstream news media, and uninformed parents and teachers who good-heartedly perform every day out of sheer ignorance and deception. So they encompasses all of those people then.
Well, that's right. And look back in your own life, Dave. I'm sure every one of those people in those categories have been guilty in deceiving you, but they didn't know it. It was unwittingly.
Yep. Well, most of them, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, if our parents went to the public schools, we can't expect them to know these things that weren't taught there.
Right.
So they pass it on to us.
Pat, like I said, it's a terrific book. Let me just go over the chapters in here. As with the moon landing chapter, which was a shock to me, I don't really want to get into the nuts and bolts. I want to leave it to the reader to do that. Of course, we have the preface, the foreword, the introduction. Introduction says media deception and racism. Section 1, the forgotten history of money. 2, Obama the usurper. 3, the moon landing hoax. 4, Ronald Reagan, the rest of him. 5, a second look at Honest Abe. 6, FDR and Social Security. 7, assassinations and the news media cover-up, Hinckley and George H.W. Bush. Tim McVeigh's government ops connection, the murder of Vince Foster. Section 8, the multifaceted JFK mysteries and others, James Earl Ray and Martin Luther King, similarities to Bremer and Wallace. Section 9, Lyndon and Madeline. That was a fascinating chapter, Pat. Section 10, the two Oswalds. 11, the murder of Pat Tillman. Another fascinating chapter. 12, who killed Robert F. Kennedy. And final chapter, section 13, Face It, America, 9/11 was an inside job. And the conclusion. All of them are absolutely wonderful. And I learned a lot from this book, Pat. I want to thank you for writing it. It is about 275 pages, and there's information on every page. What was your favorite chapter to write in this book, Pat?
Oh, boy, that's another tough question. You're full of them today. I suppose maybe the two Oswalds, because it's a case I've been in for a long time. I'll discuss that part for a second, because it is, for people who have just bought the government propaganda line all the years, they do think it's ridiculous, on the surface, without reading the book. But what had happened was these two guys were brought together when they were still in junior high school, and certainly that couldn't have been for the purpose of killing John F. Kennedy, who was still a senator. He hadn't even run for president yet in 1954. But I asked another private investigator, I said, how does this happen? This guy had been in military intelligence, and he knew a lot about the inside stuff. And he said, well, when they find somebody they want to use, they put his picture out. Of course, it's a lot easier today with the computers and email. But in those days, they would actually mail his picture around to the CIA and FBI offices around the country and say, who do you got that looks like this?
Right.
Well, eventually, a picture that they had of a man whose name was probably Alec Heidel, but we don't know this for 100% sure. But he had grown up in New York. He had Russian parents and spoke Russian fluently. And his picture eventually got down to New Orleans. And they happened to have a guy by the name of Robert Oswald, who was Lee Oswald's older brother by 2 years, who was already a young man in the Army at 17, and he was already CIA connected. They came to him, and he said, yeah, he does look like me, but I'll tell you what, he looks a whole lot more like my little brother. And they're also closer to the same age. With this, Alec Heidel was moved to New Orleans, Louisiana with his mother, and suddenly what begins to appear from the evidence researched, and I'd love to take credit for this, but I can't. It was done by a man named John Armstrong, who is not a great writer, but he must be one of the most infallible researchers in the history of authorship. He's written a 1,000-page book called Harvey and Lee. He beats a premise to death. He almost has you saying, okay, I believe you. Go to something else.
Right.
Because there was so much evidence. He had interviewed people who knew Harvey Oswald and worked with him and went to school with him and had summer jobs with him. And he interviewed people who knew Lee Oswald. And there actually were two Marguerites. And so Lee and Harvey became one in 1957 or 8. Lee joined the Marines as a high school dropout in 1956 at 17 years old. He was born October the 18th, 1939. But he is not the Lee Harvey Oswald that we all saw Jack Ruby murder on television. That was Harvey. To me, why is this one of the bigger things of the book? Because for 30 years, we were all perplexed. How can a kid drop out of high school and go to school in New Orleans, yet an accent that people never lose in a whole lifetime, and go to language school for 6 weeks in Japan in the Marines and come out speaking Russian so fluently that when he meets his future wife, Marina, in 1960, after he had jumped over to Russia, that she thinks he's a native? That was so perplexing to me, because I used to be a nightclub entertainer. I used to sing down on Bourbon Street with my guitar. I know what New Orleans folks talk like, you know, New Orleans, man.
New Orleans.
Yeah, New Orleans. They don't lose it. And it's almost as ridiculous as you meeting someone who was born in Hungary or Italy and grew up over there and at age 20 or so came over to the United States and now he's 50. Hey, you'll immediately say, hey, what part of Europe are you from, don't you?
Right.
They don't lose their accent, and Americans couldn't do that either. So that was totally impossible, and many of us knew it, but we were perplexed by it until John Armstrong came down the road in the mid-1990s with his great, great book called Harvey and Lee, and come to find out that they carried the same ID. And this was proven when an hour or so after, actually less than an hour after JFK was shot at Dealey Plaza, policeman J.D. Tippit was killed on the street down at 10th and Patton in Dallas. Now, another perplexing thing about that is Oswald went to his house. His housekeeper, Earlene Roberts, saw him come in the house, and she was watching the television, getting the news of what had happened half an hour ago. And she said Lee came in and changed his suit and put on a jacket and went out and stood at the bus stop, and she said it was 1:04. Well, Tippit was shot. The initial report said 1:07. Now, I have both driven and walked from his house at 1026 Beckley down to 10th and Patton, where the murder took place of the policeman, and it's right at a mile. So if he was standing out there at 1:04 and he was shooting the cop at 1:07, he just broke the world record in the mile in street clothes.
Right.
So we knew that couldn't be. Then the official Dallas PD records got changed to 1:15 was when Tippit was killed, but we have the initial reports that they can't change, and that is when the call first came in and received by the dispatcher. But here's the thing about the dual Oswalds. At the scene were found five ejected 38 caliber shells in the street. Well, Oswald Lee was carrying, or Harvey rather, was carrying a 38 revolver. And of course, anybody who's got the least bit of knowledge about weaponry knows that you don't eject shells from a revolver unless you intend to. It doesn't eject them like an automatic does.
Mm-hmm.
Also on the street, the detectives find a wallet. Ooh, how convenient.
Right.
And in that wallet is a photo ID of Alec Heidel and a second one of Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, it took about 25 years before a photographic expert by the name of Jack White in Fort Worth, Texas, began to show how this was a, and this indeed shows how much these two guys looked alike, but it was a composite photo of the left side of Lee's face and the right side of Harvey's.
Wow.
And it split it right down the middle vertically and put it together, and that's why they could both carry this ID, because indeed it looked like both of them. So this wallet is found in the street with the two IDs in it, and sometime later, in the next half an hour, the cops are all summoned to the Texas Theater, which is only a few blocks down the street from 10th and Patton, because somebody had sneaked in the theater and hadn't paid 50 cents for his ticket. And cops are all over the place. I mean, this is, you know, some kind of bad crime, man. You sneak in the movie theater without paying, right?
Ooh.
Yeah. So there, they arrest Lee Harvey Oswald, pull him out of his seat, and bring him outside, and he's carrying a wallet, and inside his wallet is the same ID, like Heidel and Lee Harvey Oswald. They're the same cop who arrested him, who just looked at this ID a half an hour earlier found in the street, is the one who's looking at it now, and he's saying, whoa. And by the way, he was murdered. He was murdered a few years later in a motel in Dallas. Buddy Walter.
What you've been describing here in this chapter is the way they all really play out. You've been researching this stuff for over 45 years, and I read in your book that you probably have the most complete JFK assassination library out there. Do you think that's the case?
Well, I think that might be a slight exaggeration because, you know, there are several of us. I just know that there cannot be very many in the country any bigger than mine because of what I've got and what it feels like. I can't imagine any layman, let alone another reporter, collecting this much. Mine is immense, put it that way. It's got to be one of the biggest.
Mm-hmm. Now, one chapter in this book that kind of ties all of them together from reading your fine book is Chapter 1, The Forgotten History of Money. The reason that Chapter 1, The Forgotten History of Money, ties everything together is that you claim because our money is not based on silver and gold anymore, it's based on debt, that it could be created and used for whatever purposes the people in power want. You say here on page 46, a dollar of legal tender, a Federal Reserve note, is a piece of paper that the first user gets for nothing and for which the last user will get nothing. Was I right about that, that it ties in all the chapters together?
Certainly. It gives the power, unlimited power, to government. People all the time say to me, well, who cares whether our paper money is backed by gold or silver or not, as long as a grocer will take it. It's a common argument. Well, they don't understand that when we had circulating gold and silver coin as money, There was a death penalty for counterfeiting, by the way. That's how important it was to the founders. Mm-hmm. And the coins, of course, were the money, but it became convenient over the years to have paper in your wallet, which was the receipt for the money that was down in what they called the warehouse. And they later became known as banks. So one would deposit his gold or silver coin because it was cumbersome to carry around and also not real safe from robbers. So by depositing it in the warehouse with a trusted manager to look after it for them, that manager at that warehouse, that bank, would issue him a receipt. And that receipt later evolved into the United States currency, which said, this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private, and is redeemable in lawful money at the United States Treasury or any Federal Reserve Bank. Now, what was lawful money? Lawful money was a dollar, in fact, is still by law 25.8 grains of gold or 371.5 grains of silver.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was lawful money by law. And to counterfeit that was a death penalty. Well, what they've done, and they did, as these notes of series 1950 was the last one that had that redeemability clause on it. And in 1963 was the first fraudulent, what I call counterfeit Federal Reserve note, came out. Then it said this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private. Didn't even put a period on there, or save an ink, I guess. But guess when they came out, Dave? Guess when they hit the street?
When?
The week of John F. Kennedy's funeral, when it would be buried in the back pages of the paper somewhere, when people couldn't care less. I mean, it was just so surreptitiously slipped in on us.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I was 23 at the time, talking to my dad about it. I said, you know, this looks counterfeit. Well, son, if the U.S. government's put a stamp of approval on it, then it must be okay.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's red, white, and blue fever, you know.
Right. What is red, white, and blue fever? What does that mean?
That's a fever that the Bush-enamored right-wing Republican, and especially the guys who fought in World War II, because they take a certain pride in the country and what they fought for, and deservedly so.
Right.
But what they don't understand is we've had no declared war since 1945. Korea was a fraudulent banker's war. Vietnam was a banker's and drug war for drugs and money. And the same thing's happening now in the Middle East with the oil and, of course, the poppy seeds we talk about with Pat Tillman. There comes a point where these guys begin to shake their red, white, and blue fever. And by the way, there was no prouder American than the guy you're talking to right now, you know, in the 1960s. And I said some stupid things back in the 60s in Vietnam, you know, we ought to nuke them and this sort of stuff. But I didn't understand.
Right.
You know, I had red, white, and blue fever.
I think probably all of us at one time or another have had it, right?
Sure. But it's starting to get exposed. On June the 24th, 1968, was the day the banker's window slammed shut and we could no longer redeem our lawful notes. I have one in my wallet. I call it Pat Shannon's 10-Minute Coffee Shop Seminar. Whenever somebody wants to talk about it, I pull it out and show them what money the receipts for the gold and silver used to look like. But what they did, they changed the receipt for the lawful money in the warehouse. They changed it into the actual entity. And they said, this is a dollar. Well, a dollar is a measurement. It's like a quart or a mile, an inch.
Right.
It's a measurement of something, and it's a measurement of gold and silver, but they have turned it into the entity. And since 1968, we haven't been able to redeem it for anything but another cheap piece of paper. I'm really glad you asked this question and cited that quote, because it's never been more evident to the average American on the street than right now. Obama created a trillion, remember, a trillion out of thin air? People wanted to call that taxpayers' money. Dave, that's no more taxpayers' money. It's nothing but sand from a beach. I mean, it's just created out of thin air. It is totally worthless, and it dilutes. It's like pouring water into the milk. Right now, that dollar of 1964, four silver quarters, would buy about 4 gallons of gasoline. All right? Let's take the silver market today and what they call junk silver, the pre-1965 silver coin, a $1,000 bag of silver, $1,000 by measurement in that bag, today costs you about $22,000. $22,000 in counterfeit to trade for $1,000 in lawful money. They says this is taxpayers' money. It's not taxpayers' money. It hasn't been since 1968. Your taxes have gone for nothing. They go into the federal sewer.
Mm-hmm.
And government creates as much as they need to create, and it also gives them unlimited power. And so many Americans wonder why this good, clean, living Christian businessman who wasn't even a lawyer gets elected to Congress, and he goes up there, and boy, he's going to change things. And 6 months later, you can hardly even recognize how he's voting. Who is this clown?
Right.
What happened was, you know, you drop $500,000 in cash on a guy's desk, you can have a lot of influence on how he votes.
Right. And because it's not tied to silver or gold, and it comes out of thin air, that's no problem for these guys. That's what you're saying, right?
See, originally, the founders fixed it so the states had to supply the federal government, something called apportionment. And so whenever the feds wanted to do anything, any kind of project, going to build a highway from New York to San Francisco, it's going to cost this many dollars. And they have to apportion the states. First of all, they got to get the state capitals, the state legislators to decide. Okay, yeah, this sounds good.
Mm-hmm. That's the way that federalism was supposed to work, right?
Right. And so if Mississippi had 2 million people and California had 20 million people, then California's tab was 10 times as much because that was equal apportionment. Therefore, each individual citizen of those states was still paying the same, wasn't he?
Yeah, he is. He's paying the same amount, exactly.
So that was what apportionment was, and this is how the federal government remained small until 1913 when the Federal Reserve came along and began to counterfeit money.
Mm-hmm.
That's why today I've started to make the example of 21 times as much. So 22 times as much, it's hard to keep a thumb on. In the book, by the way, I use 16. That's how much it's increased since September. Well, now we're at almost 22. Now, let's just use the figure 20 because it's easier for people to grasp in their head.
Mm-hmm.
If you say 20 in, say, $3, $3 being the thing we just broke in the last few weeks on the gasoline cost around the country, most of them are around $3 right now.
Right.
Divide it by 20, and you get 15 cents. That same 25-cent gallon of 1964 gasoline actually is costing far less, almost half as much. And that's because of more efficient manufacturing technology, all the various things that we've had great improvements.
Right, economies of scale and so on and so forth.
Yeah, but if you put that formula to any product on the market today, you'll see the prices have not gone up at all. But the value of the buck has been so diluted, it takes so many more of them, even for the necessities anymore. It is strangling the American people. Mm-hmm. And they still got these conservative congressmen and economists, and I said put conservative in quotes,
mm-hmm.
all saying, oh, yeah, it's just a great waste of taxpayers' money. Sorry, does not compute.
So like you say on page 38, Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution says, no state shall make anything except gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts. That's still there in the Constitution. And what changed that was never ratified, you were saying?
No, what changed that was the Fed coming in the back door and, well, with the ability to create money out of thin air, they can get a lot of things done behind the scenes in the judiciary as well. And what became their plea and their legal standing was, that no state was doing it. The federal government was doing it. And so they became a great challenge back in the 1980s, instigated by Tupper Saucy and others, to say, okay, let's challenge them on this. The failure to pay a car tag or property taxes or these sorts of things will challenge them to say, okay, tell us what is the lawful money of this land and what's the money of a county of the United States. And so there were some great cases back in the 80s, and I was involved in that movement myself. But you couldn't very well do it on property taxes if the government's going to ignore your challenge. They just take your property from you. So as far as the Federal Reserve note being a piece of paper that the first user gets for nothing, I think we've made that obvious in the last few minutes because the Federal Reserve prints it for nothing. But now, as I say, it's more evident today than ever before. When just since September, we've gone from $16 for that to $22, it should become very evident that the time is around the corner when the last user is going to get nothing for it. It happened in Germany, 1923. People were wallpapering a bathroom with Deutschmarks. One of my favorite stories was the woman who was standing in line during the Great Depression in Germany in 1923 with her small child, and she had a bushel basket full of Deutschmarks going into to the grocery store to get some necessities. And her little four-year-old child broke and ran and down the street, and she set down the basket where she's standing in line between many other people and ran to get her kid, and when she came back in 30 seconds, the bushel basket gone with the Deutschmark spread all over the sidewalk.
They left the money, right?
It was worth more than the money.
It's not something to laugh about.
Well, that's where we're headed right now with the Federal Reserve note. The
inflation.
Last user is going to get nothing for it.
Right. If gold and silver still existed for the purposes that the founders put in the Constitution, would there be inflation?
The answer to that is there was less than 1% variation in inflation in America in the first 125 years. It was in 1913 or 1914 when the first Federal Reserve Bank opened that inflation began.
Right. This has always been a problem in American history, as you mentioned here on page 44. I read that quote before from, I think that was 1828, now from 1787, from a letter from John Adams to Thomas Jefferson. All the perplexities, confusion, and distress in America arise not from defects in the Constitution or Confederation, nor from a want of honor or virtue, so much as from downright ignorance of the nature of coin, credit, and circulation. And I'll ask again, Pat, Is anything ever going to change?
Well, it certainly will not be changed as long as they have control of the media, will it?
No.
That's about the only source of education adults have. After they get out of college and, you know, go to work and have a family, their only local knowledge of what's going on is from the local newspaper. Their only national knowledge is from the nightly news.
Right.
So as long as those who are in control don't want us to know it, we won't. And once again, it's a vicious circle because it's the power of the legal tender that allows them to keep this choking grasp on our necks. You know, a couple of my favorite quotes in there on those pages, where you are or near, is the letters from Washington to Lafayette.
Right, they were great.
Oh, yeah, and but he just said, I wouldn't have believed after 1789, after the ratification, I think it was probably 91 by the time he wrote this letter, but he said, in 6 months, it's changed because they had lawful money, the dollar was strong, and he said, I wouldn't have believed it. You can read the quote there if you see it. I can't quote it verbatim, but he was so concerned back in 1786 or 7 when we still had the counterfeit called Continental Notes at that time, and which had become worthless.
Yeah, I remember reading those quotes. I'm looking at them right now. I want to save it for the reader to check that out because that is very powerful. You're a powerful writer. And on page 13, I love what you say here. While stupid people would not watch intelligent television very long, intelligent people will watch stupid television for hours on end. And they'll pick up their cell phones and they'll text for hours on end. They'll get tattoos. They'll talk on the phone. Is it ever going to change if this is what they want?
Well, do you think so many Americans would have tattoos all over their bodies were it not for it being so publicized on television? And their athletic heroes, the basketball players and the others, and parade up and down the court with all that ink over the back of them? Now, they're going to pay a price for that, by the way. And I'm just reading a story that's not long ago of a woman who had a tattoo on her lower back, right above her hiney, and she had a back problem. I believe it might have been an auto accident where
right.
She needed an operation to fix that, and they could not cut through that because of the poison and the ink.
By the way, that's called a tramp stamp.
Okay, thank you. I didn't know that.
No, it's really not. That's just a slang term for one of those tattoos in that place.
Well, apparently not only would this ink poison her body if they cut through it right now, but it's going to seep through anyway, I am told. And so these people that get these tattoos in their 20s are going to pay a great price when they get in their 60s.
Yeah, I was in the Navy. I never got a tattoo. It's a lot to think about. It's a lot to go up against. It's a lot to imagine that the country will latch on to these ideas. They will put away the remote. I personally haven't watched TV in over 20 years. They will pick up books. It's something that we could wish and hope for. Let me just say that, and I should have mentioned this earlier, but I'll say it now. If this is something that you're interested in, folks, and you want to get Pat's book, Everything They Ever Told Me Was a Lie, there's two ways to do it. The first is you can order by phone. You can pick up your phone and call 888-699-NEWS. That's 888-699-NEWS. And news breaks down to 6397. 6397, 888-699-6397. You can do that. Or, alternatively, if you have access to the internet, you could go to www.americanfreepress.net. Click one of the top tabs that says bookstore, and it's prominently placed right there. Everything They Ever Told Me Was a Lie. Pat, how much is the book?
$30. $30 of counterfeit. In fact, funny you should ask, because on my own website, I get a kick out of pricing my book two ways. AFP hasn't done this, but I'd like to kind of give another illustration on how their money is disappearing.
Right.
I sell the book for $2. $2 of lawful money. That's pre-1965 coin, of course. And occasionally I get somebody who will, you know, send me $2 in coin.
Right.
But I get a boot out of it because at the time I did that, the book was $30, and the exchange rate, as you see in the book in September, was 16-1, wasn't it?
Right. Now it's 22.
So if they sent me $2 of lawful money, they were actually sending me 32 instead of 30. But now if they send me $2 of lawful money, they're sending me 44 in counterfeit.
What is your website, Pat?
PatShannon.net.
Okay. And that's, of course, S-H-A-N-N-A-N. Okay, PatShannon.net. You started researching this book when, Pat?
I say 4 years in the book, but some of the stuff that is in there, of course, is 40 years old. But actually writing it and putting it together and saving it here, there, and yon, 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why we're having a volume two, because when AFP looked at it, it was just ended up being way too much information.
How many volumes are forthcoming?
Well, at least a volume two, but if the subject matter is such that it could go on for the rest of my life, who knows? I mean, we found out a long time ago a Bush can lie just as well as a Clinton, so we never run out of fodder.
Well, that's good, and I hope that you do write it, and I want to thank you so much for writing this book. It's terrific. Everything they ever told me was a lie. You can get it from American Free Press by calling 888-699-NEWS, 888-699-NEWS, or go to AmericanFreePress.net, click on the bookstore tab, you can buy it through there, or you can go to Pat's own website, which is www.patshannon.net, that's S-H-A-N-N-A-N.net, and of course it's $30 plus shipping. Or Pat takes real money. Is it still too real?
It will always be $2.
It'll always be $2. No matter what happens, it's going to always be $2.
That's right. And I don't want them sending me $2 in counterfeit either. And it takes 30 of that right now. But looking forward to doing volume 2, and I hope everyone enjoys it as much as you have, Dave.
Yeah, I really did enjoy it. A terrific book. Highly recommended. Everything they ever told me was a lie. Pat, thanks so much for the time you took out today. Really looking forward to the next volume. When do you expect it might be out?
Our target is April, but the way things normally go, it'd probably be June.
Is it going to be called Everything They Ever Told Me Was a Lie, Volume 2?
Correct.
Well, thanks again, Pat, and appreciate the time you took out, and hope you have a Merry Christmas.
And you too, Dave, and thanks for calling.